But welcome back once again to One Step Beyond. I'm now going to give a rundown of what it is we're going to be covering in tonight's broadcast. Again, tonight's program is something of a two-part program. There will be some very important related material that I will carry on with next week. I had originally planned on trying to do it all this evening, but there's too much material for 4 hours, so we will have the Operation Gladio section this evening, then some phone calls, and then Rex 84, the related martial law contingency plans, the state defense forces, etc. Domestic Gladio really is what it is and what I will be referring to it as. We will be talking about that next week. We're going to begin this evening with a very important article, part of which I read and part of which I will reread this evening from the current issue of Covert Action Information Bulletin. What we're going to be doing this evening is examining a relatively new element. It's something I've spoken about before. It's something that the late Mabe Russell, the greatest political researcher in this country's recent history, perhaps with the exception of George Seldes, it's something that Mabe Russell spoke about for many years. We're going to be talking about something which wields a profound influence on the world today, something whose mere very existence has been largely concealed from even the most astute observers, and it's something which has been very tragically relegated to fiction. It is something that is only too real, something which exerts a profound influence on us today, and something we're going to be looking at this evening. What we're going to be talking about is something called the Odessa, basically the post-World War II Nazi underground centered on and involving primarily the SS, Hitler's elite order, basically the group of stone killers who did most of Adolf Hitler's dirty work during the Second World War, and who have done most of Adolf Hitler's and subsequently the United States' dirty work during the post-World War II period. We're going to be talking about the Odessa. We're going to be talking about its influence in Italy, and next week, by extension, its influence to a certain extent in the United States. The Odessa is literally, as I spoke about last week, and we will refer to again this week, represents a Trojan horse, literally a fifth column within the United States, and it has, in considerable measure, conquered, I mean literally conquered in a military as well as an economic sense, the United States. We will be talking about the Odessa, a functioning organization within our national security establishment and its influence both on this country and on Europe this evening. We will begin with a very important article from the current issue of Covert Action Information Bulletin, or the latest issue, issue number 35 from the fall of 1990. I will add some material and reread some critical material by author Carl Oglesby from Covert Action Information Bulletin. We will then jump directly to what is, for all practical purposes, a manifestation of the Odessa, the SS, international fascism in Italy, namely Operation Gladio. We will begin the hard discussion of Gladio with a column I have read before on this program, this by Warren Hinkle of the San Francisco Examiner, one of the excellent columns in his ongoing series called George Bush and the Drug Wars. We're then going to take a look at an article from the San Francisco Chronicle from this past November. It will overlap considerably and to a certain extent will serve in apposition to the material from Warren Hinkle's column. Both of these articles will get the listeners introduced in a fairly straightforward form to Operation Gladio. We will then look at yet another article from the San Francisco Examiner. This came from the following day, the 2 days being November 14th and 15th of 1990, respectively. And that will talk about the Operation Gladio, basically the guerrilla program in Western Europe as well. And that will serve, again, in apposition to a certain extent to the material in the first two articles. We will then take a look at a short article from the Village Voice, specifically Doug Ireland's press clips section, and that will serve to kick off the hard discussion on Operation Gladio, which will center in considerable measure, as have many broadcasts in the past, on the magnificent work that's been done for us and is being done for us by Dave, our Italian translator. He is not Italian himself, but he translates Italian and also is now learning German, and he has been doing some fantastic work for us in the past, and it continues to do that work, and we are extremely lucky to have access to his terrific efforts. We're going to take a look at a very important article from L'Espresso from November 25th of 1990, talking about Gladio and talking about the institution of Project Gladio. What that is, I will talk about later. And we're going to see names like Theodore Shackley, Alexander Haig, Henry Kissinger, as well as Licio Gelli, Grand Master of the Propaganda Douay Lodge, a former Oberleutnant in the SS, and a very, very important figure in the post-World War II period, an individual whose influence continues to be felt all over the world, in particular in the United States. Tragically, like so many critical elements of contemporary political reality, Licio Gelli, the P2 Lodge, have largely escaped the notice of even the so-called alternative press. That terrible, terrible gap that, in my opinion, deliberate amnesia is something which has caused us a great deal of trouble, and it is going to be causing us a whole lot more trouble in the near future, barring some significant changes. We will then review a short article, again coming from Dave, our Italian translator from La Repubblica of August 4th of 1990, talking about how the CIA station chief in Italy, a fellow named Randolph Stone, was actually a member of the Propaganda Due Lodge, which, to make a long story short, was a bogus Masonic lodge. It was actually instituted as a Masonic lodge, but unlike so many Masonic lodges, which are what they represent themselves as being, they are fraternal organizations, this particular Masonic lodge served as a front for covert action and basically crypto-fascist activity in Italy. For all practical purposes, it ran and continues to run Italy. We're then going to look at another very important article, this predating the recent revelations concerning Gladio proper. This comes from L'Espresso of June 1st of 1986, and we're going to look at names like Claire Sterling and Michael Ledeen and their direct intersection with the P2 and with the operations which have subsequently been revealed as related to and involved with the Gladio Project. The next article we will be looking at again comes from Dave, our Italian translator, a very important article from La Repubblica of November 28th of 1987. Again, predating the formal revelations of Gladio, but intersecting heavily with the activities attendant on Gladio, we'll be taking a look at a very important element of continuity between the Third Reich and the fascism of Mussolini's Italy and the contemporary political realities not only in Italy, but also by extension the rest of Europe and last, but most assuredly not least, the United States. After that, we will be reviewing a key section of one of the most important articles of the many gems that have been unearthed and translated for us by Dave. This comes from L'Europeo of August 25th of 1990. We're going to review the American connection to P2, Amitalia, the International Fund for Mergers and Acquisitions, and the revelation by, among others, Arif Durrani, as well as Richard Brennecke, a former CIA operative and a person very knowledgeable about P2 and Gladio. We're going to take a look at how Oliver North's enterprise has succeeded and assumed the function of Amitalia, the CIA's link and direct funding connection to the aforementioned Operation Gladio and P2. We will conclude with an article which will act as a bridge to next week's program. To a certain extent, the Europeo material will as well. What we're going to be looking at is a transcript of an article that was mentioned by a caller from Berkeley last week. Not an article, but a transcript of an item carried on the KPFA Evening News of December 27th. A chilling article perhaps portending a provocation attendant on the Middle East, or at the very least a propaganda campaign apparently being waged by element or elements unknown. We will talk about that, and I certainly hope that there is no breakout of war in the Middle East. As I said last week, I think that ultimately war in the Middle East is going to be, to a certain extent at least, irrelevant. I think conditions here in the United States, and they continue to worsen economically, are going to mandate at some point, I don't know when, as I have said in the past, at some point they are going to mandate the institution of some of the martial law contingency plans that we have spoken about in programs like Radio Free America 32. And I think the worsening economic conditions at some point, I don't know when, but I'm afraid it may be relatively soon, those worsening economic conditions and the resulting social dislocation will warrant the institution of those programs to a certain extent, in my opinion. And I hope I'm wrong. I'm afraid I'm right. That's what we have on tap for this evening. A little more music, and then the main body of tonight's Operation Gladio Archive show. Well, good evening. Welcome back once again to One Step Beyond. It's time now to begin tonight's archive show. We're going to be dealing tonight with something called Operation Gladio. That basically was a, quote, anti-communist underground guerrilla contingency plan put together in Italy and elsewhere in Europe. The Gladio name applied to Italy, but a similar program was instituted in other European countries under NATO auspices. But by way of easing into the Gladio discussion, we are going to be taking a look at some material which I have spoken about in the past on this broadcast. We will be entering it into the archives. Some of this you've heard before, some will be new. There is a very, very important article in the current issue of Covert Action Information Bulletin. That issue specifically is number 35 from the fall of 1990. Covert Action is a quarterly, And I'm going to give you the address because Back Issues, and that's a very important publication, are available. Covert Action Information Bulletin is available from P.O. Box 34583, P.O. Box 34583, that's in Washington, D.C., zip code 20043. Once again, Covert Action Information Bulletin, P.O. Box 34583, Washington, D.C., 20043. And I strongly recommend that listeners get in the habit of following this publication and obtaining Back Issues, which are available from that address. Now, it's worth noting here, before we go into this very important essay by Carl Oglesby, last name O-G-L-E-S-B-Y, the author of, among other books, The Yankee and Cowboy War that we've used in the past on this broadcast, it's worth perhaps going into a little bit of the history of the Second World War and the Third Reich in particular. One of the things that has not been recognized by historians, military and political historians in particular, is that the Third Reich began making plans for its demise for quite some time during the Second World War. The military defeat of the Third Reich was, for all intents and purposes, assured by the Battle of Stalingrad in the Soviet Union. That took place, that concluded in early 1943. In fact, the German General Staff had concluded that that Germany was going to lose the war by October of 1941. In other words, even before the United States was in the war. In October of 41, the German High Command realized that they were not going to be able to knock the Soviet Union out of the war before the coming of the Soviet winter. Their plan was contingent on knocking the Soviet Union out. This meant basically, to make a long story short, and I'm going to be giving an abbreviated version of some of these events here before we get into the Oglesby article, the German High Command knew that their chances for success on the Eastern Front depended on a war of movement when they realized they were going to be unable to knock the Soviet Union out of the war in the first, or before the coming of the harsh Soviet winter, the harsh Russian winter. They realized that the war was going to be turning into a war of attrition, which favored in the long term the Soviets and the other allies. By October of 1941, the Germans knew that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor. That would pull the United States into the war. And so the Germans knew basically that they were going to be facing the most populous countries and the most profound manufacturing powers in the world. Basically, the most populous country in the world was China. That was on the side of the Allies. The second most populous was the Soviet Union. That was on the side of the Allies. The India, basically, which is now an independent country, was actually part of the British Empire, was actually the second most populous behind China. That was on the Allied side. The United States was going to be coming in on the Allied side. And with the manufacturing power of the British Empire, the United States, and the Soviet Union, and all of that population, the German High Command knew that the Axis was militarily doomed. The hardcore of the Nazi Party, the top leadership as well as the SS, concluded that after the Battle of Stalingrad. The point being that for more than 2 years before the formal end of the Second World War, the Germans were making formal preparation for their post-World War II survival, and they were very successful and very elaborate in their preparations for the perpetuation of the Reich underground and abroad following World War II. That perpetuation of the Third Reich, abroad and underground, is basically the Odessa. There are a number of post-World War II Third Reich organizations. They are closely related. Der Spinne is one of them. That is frequently confused with the Odessa. Also, an organization put together by Hans-Ulrich Rudel, a very much decorated Luftwaffe pilot, called the Kameradenwerk. That also intersects closely with the Odessa and is often confused with it. The point that we are making here is that, contrary to pop history, and tragically that's the history that has been proliferated to us, the Third Reich did not disappear with its formal military defeat in 1945. On the contrary, the Third Reich was eclipsed. It was hidden from view, but it did not go away. And it not only didn't go away, but the profound fascist sympathies of many of the top industrialists and financiers around the world, in particular the United States, which we went into in the first two Radio Free America shows, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, Uncle Sam and Il Duce, a program about Japanese fascism called Japanese Fascism, Its History and Significance for Contemporary Americans. Also Radio Free America number 10, go into that in considerable detail. Archives on Audio has that information. We spoke about the Odessa and its incorporation into the Galen organization, the Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit that we took in at the end of World War II, in Radio Free America number 3. What we're going to be taking a look at this evening by way of easing into Operation Gladio is the Galen organization and its basic function as a front for the Odessa, and ultimately, as I reviewed last week and have referred to before, as a Trojan horse, literally a vehicle for the economic and political conquest of the United States, that conquest not having been accessible to the Germans during World War II militarily. They accomplished it politically and economically, largely through the Odessa and its inclusion and operations through the organization of a man named Reinhard Galen. Now, Reinhard Galen, last name G-E-H-L-E-N, was Hitler's chief of intelligence for the Eastern Front during World War II. Hitler's Eastern Front intelligence organization, called Fremde Heere Ost, or Foreign Armies East, abbreviated FHO, was incorporated into the CIA at the end of World War II and became, for all intents and purposes, its Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs. It then became the de facto NATO intelligence organization, supplying NATO with up to roughly three-fourths of its intelligence. Finally, it was included with the incorporation of the Federal Republic of Germany in 1956 as the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the BND, the West German Intelligence Service, which it is to this day. It's worth noting that, as we will look at in this article, the Galen organization basically served as a vehicle for the introduction of thousands of SS and Gestapo veterans, many of them war criminals of the First Order, not only into the West German National Security Establishment, but in particular into ours as well, and they have served a profound and very deadly function in the United States, ranging from giving us bad and deliberately misleading intelligence on Soviet capabilities and intentions, which then led to the arms race, which has bankrupted us and turned us into an economic basket case. Beyond that, the Galen organization played a profound role in a number of America's political tragedies, notably and most significantly the assassination of President Kennedy, as we looked at in The Guns of November, Part 4, Radio Free America Show 11, and 13 and 15 as well. Those are available from Archives on Audio. What we're going to be looking at this evening is the Odessa, Operation Gladio, the Odessa, the Galen organization, and how that organization, the Galen organization and its influence on the U.S. national security establishment has basically influenced the post-World War II period. We will be taking a look at Operation Gladio, which, in my opinion, represents a European manifestation of the Odessa, of the post-World War II fascist and Nazi underground, and it's not really so underground, just tragically ignored. And we will be talking about that and carrying that on next week in our discussion of Oliver North's Enterprise, the Rex 84 Martial Law Contingency Plan, the State Defense Forces, and a number of very sinister elements which may very soon be very much in front of our eyes if the worst comes to pass in the Middle East and around here. We're now going to begin by taking a look at the Nazis going underground. And by the way, in the first two Radio Free America shows, primarily number one, we relied on a very important article, a very important book, I should say, that book called The Nazis Go Underground by Kurt Reese. Before I included that into Radio Free America number one, many listeners who have been with us for some time have heard the late, great Mae Russell talk about that book. In fact, it was Mae who bequeathed that to me and permitted its inclusion into Radio Free America number one. What we're going to be looking at this evening is the Odessa, the Galen organization's relationship to it. By the way, the Galen organization, Radio Free America references the first three Radio Free America shows, number 11, number 15, and number 22, go into the Galen organization at considerable length. We also touch on it in number 21 as well. There are other Galen references, but those are the most significant. This article this evening, and I've read parts of it before, is called The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt. Actually, it's called Reinhard Galen, The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt by Carl Oglesby, again, O-G-L-E-S-B-Y, an important writer who, once again, whose book, The Yankee and Cowboy War, we've used in the past. He talks about the Galen organization, and he echoes here a theme that I have sounded before on this program, that the United States literally, I mean literally, lost the Second World War. I am not using a metaphor or literary device of any type. I mean this absolutely literally. And as Oglesby once again has echoed me here, the Galen organization basically served as a Trojan horse for the political and economic conquest of the United States. We're going to begin with the very beginning of Oglesby's article as he talks about the Nazis going underground and the formation of the Odessa and the post-World War II Nazi and Fascist Underground. William Shirer closed his 1960 masterpiece, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, with a judgment that the Nazi regime, quote, had passed into history, unquote, but we cannot be so confident today. On the contrary, the evidence as of 1990 is that World War II did not end as Shirer believed it did, that Nazism did not surrender unconditionally and disappear, that indeed, it finessed a limited but crucial victory over the Allies, a victory no less significant for having been kept a secret from all but the few Americans who were directly involved. That last couple of sentences again, at the risk of seeming repetitive, because it is the thesis statement and in many, many ways the key to tonight's broadcast. William Shirer, S-H-I-R-E-R, by the way, closed his 1960 masterpiece, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, with a judgment that the Nazi regime, quote, had passed into history, unquote, but we cannot be so confident today. On the contrary, the evidence as of 1990 is that World War II did not end as Shirer believed it did, that Nazism did not surrender unconditionally and disappear, that indeed it finessed a limited but crucial victory over the Allies, a victory no less significant for having been kept a secret from all but the few Americans who were directly involved. Hitler continued to rant of victory, but after Germany's massive defeat in the Battle of Stalingrad in mid-January of 1943, the realists of the German General Staff, OKW, were all agreed that their game was lost. Defeat at Stalingrad meant at a minimum that Germany could not win the war in the East that year. I'm going to take a break here. We're having some technical problems, and when those problems are concluded, I will resume the broadcast. Proceeding now with a section of Carl Oglesby's article called The Odessa and Its Mission. Hitler continued to rant of victory, but after Germany's massive defeat in the Battle of Stalingrad in mid-January of 1943, the realists of the German General Staff, OKW, were all agreed that their game was lost. Defeat at Stalingrad meant, at a minimum, that Germany could not win the war in the East that year. This, in turn, meant that the Nazis would have to keep the great preponderance of their military forces tied down on the Eastern Front and could not redeploy them to the West, where the Anglo-American invasion of Italy would occur that summer. Apparently inspired by the Soviet victory, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Prime Minister Winston Churchill announced at Casablanca on January 24, 1943, their demand for Germany's unconditional surrender and the complete denazification of Europe. Within the German General Staff, two competing groups formed around the question of what to do, one led by Heinrich Himmler, the other by Martin Bormann. Himmler was chief of the SS, Schutzstaffel, or protective echelon, quote-unquote, the black-shirted corps of the Nazi Party that emerged as Hitler's bodyguard in the late 1920s and grew into the most powerful of the Nazi political institutions. After the failure of the attempted military coup of July 20, 1944, which wounded but did not kill Hitler, the SS seized all power and imposed a furious blood purge of the armed forces, in which some 7,000 were arrested and nearly 5,000 executed. The SS was, at that point, the only organ of the Nazi state. Himmler's plan for dealing with the grim situation facing Nazism found its premise in Hitler's belief that the alliance between the ultra-capitalists, quote-unquote, of the U.S., and the ultra-Marxist, quote-unquote, of the Soviet Union was politically unstable. That last sentence again, because it's an important one. Himmler's plan for dealing with the grim situation facing Nazism found its premise in Hitler's belief that the alliance between the ultra-capitalists, quote-unquote, of the U.S., and the ultra-Marxist, quote-unquote, of the Soviet Union was politically unstable. Quote, "Even now they are at loggerheads," said Hitler. "If we can now deliver a few more blows, this artificially bolstered common front may suddenly collapse with a gigantic clap of thunder," unquote. Himmler believed that this collapse would occur and that the U.S. would then consider the formation of a new anti-Soviet alliance with Nazi Germany. The Nazis would then negotiate a separate peace, unquote, unquote, with the United States, separate from any peace with the USSR, with which Germany would remain at war, now joined against the Soviets by the United States. Last sentence again, because although this did not happen during the actual fighting during World War II, it basically happened after the war, and that this alliance, this realignment, basically is what we have come to know as the Cold War. Himmler believed that this collapse would occur, and that the U.S. would then consider the formation of a new anti-Soviet alliance with Nazi Germany. The Nazis would then negotiate, quote, a separate peace, quote unquote, with the United States, separate from any peace with the USSR, with which Germany would remain at war, now joined against the Soviets by the United States. But Martin Bormann, who was even more powerful than Himmler, did not accept the premise of the separate peace idea. Bormann was an intimate of Hitler's, the deputy Führer and the head of the Nazi Party, thus superior to Himmler in rank. Bormann wielded additional power as Hitler's link to the industrial and financial cartels that ran the Nazi economy and was particularly close to Hermann Schmitz, chief executive of IG Farben, the giant chemical firm that was Nazi Germany's greatest industrial power. With the support of Schmitz, Bormann rejected Himmler's separate peace strategy on the ground that it was far too optimistic. The Allied military advantage was too great, Bormann believed, for Roosevelt to be talked into a separate peace. Roosevelt, after all, had taken the lead in proclaiming the Allies' demand for Germany's unconditional surrender and total denazification. Bormann reasoned, rather, that the Nazis' best hope of surviving military defeat lay within their own resources, chief of which was the cohesion of tens of thousands of SS men for whom the prospect of surrender could offer only the gallows. That one last sentence again. Bormann reasoned, rather, that the Nazis' best hope of surviving military defeat lay within their own resources, chief of which was the cohesion of tens of thousands of SS men for whom the prospect of surrender could offer only the gallows. Bormann and Schmitz developed a more aggressive, self-contained approach to the problem of the looming military defeat, the central concept of which was that large numbers of Nazis would have to leave Europe and, at least for a time, find places in the world in which to recover their strength. There were several possibilities in Latin America, most notably Argentina and Paraguay, South Africa, Egypt, and Indonesia were also attractive rear areas in which to retreat. After the German defeat in the Battle of Normandy in June of 1944, Bormann took the first external steps toward implementing concrete plans for the Nazis' great escape. An enormous amount of Nazi treasure had to be moved out of Europe and made safe. This treasure was apparently divided into several caches, of which the one at the Reichsbank in Berlin included almost 3 tons of gold, much of it the so-called tooth gold from the slaughter camps, as well as silver, platinum, tens of thousands of carats of precious stones, and perhaps $1 billion in various currencies. There were industrial assets to be expatriated, including large tonnages of specialty steel and certain industrial machinery, as well as blueprints critical to the domination of certain areas of manufacturing. Key Nazi companies needed to be relicensed outside Germany in order to escape the reach of war reparations claims. And tens of thousands of Nazi war criminals, almost all of them members of the SS, needed help to escape Germany and safely regroup in foreign colonies capable of providing security and livelihoods. For help with the first three of these tasks, Bormann convened a secret lodge of key German industrialists on August 10, 1944, at the Hotel Maison Rouge in Strasbourg. One part of the minutes of this meeting states, quote, "The Nazi Party is ready to supply large amounts of money to those industrialists who contribute to the post-war organization abroad. In return, the party demands all financial reserves which have already been transferred abroad or may later be transferred, so that after the defeat, a strong new Reich can be built." The Nazi expert in this area was Hitler's one-time financial genius and Minister of the Economy, Dr. Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht, S-C-H-A-C-H-T, available to Bormann even though he was in prison on suspicion of involvement in the anti-Hitler coup of 1944. According to a U.S. Treasury Department report of 1945, at least 750 enterprises financed by the Nazi Party had been set up outside Germany by the end of the war. These firms were capable of generating an annual income of approximately $30 million, all of it available to Nazi causes. It was Schacht's ability to finesse the legalities of licensing and ownership that brought the situation about. Organizing the physical removal of the Nazis' material assets and the escape of SS personnel were the tasks of the hulking Otto Skorzeny, simultaneously an officer of the SS, the Gestapo, and the Waffen-SS, as well as Hitler's favorite commando. Skorzeny worked closely with Bormann and Schacht in transporting the Nazi assets to safety outside Europe and in creating a network of SS escape routes or rat lines that led from all over Germany to the Bavarian city of Memmingen, then to Rome, then by sea to a number of Nazi retreat colonies set up in the global south. The international organization created to accommodate Bormann's plans is most often called the ODESSA, a German acronym for Organization of Veterans of the SS, quote unquote. It has remained active as a shadowy presence since the war and may indeed constitute Nazism's most notable organizational achievement. That last sentence again. It has remained active as a shadowy presence since the war, and may indeed constitute Nazism's most notable organizational achievement. But we must understand that none of Bormann's, Skorzeny's, and Schacht's well-laid plans would have stood the least chance of succeeding had it not been for a final component of their organization, one not usually associated with the Odessa at all, but very possibly the linchpin of the entire project. This final element of the Odessa was the so-called Galen organization, the Org, the Nazi intelligence system that sold itself to the U.S. at the end of the war. It was by far the most audacious, most critical, and most essential part of the entire Odessa undertaking. The literature on the Odessa and that on the Galen organization, however, are two different things. No writer in the field of Nazi studies has yet explicitly associated the two, despite the fact that General Reinhard Galen was tied politically as well as personally with Skorzeny and Schacht. I would interrupt the text at this point to say that is not strictly true. Author Glenn Infield, in his book Skorzeny, Hitler's Commando, has indeed associated those, and yours truly, in Radio Free America number 3, quoted Infield, so this is less than accurate here on this particular point. Beginning again, the literature on the Odessa and that on the Galen organization, however, are two different things. No writer in the field of Nazi studies has yet explicitly associated the two, despite the fact that General Reinhard Galen was tied politically as well as personally with Skorzeny and Schacht. Moreover, Galen's fabled post-war organization was in large part staffed by SS Nazis who are positively identified with the Odessa, men such as the infamous Franz Alfred Sieks and Emil Augsburg of the Wannsee Institute. Wannsee is W-A-N-N-S-E-E. An even more compelling reason for associating Galen with the Odessa is that, without his organization as a screen, the various Odessa projects would have been directly exposed to American intelligence. If the Counterintelligence Corps, CIC, and the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, had not been neutralized by the Galen ploy, the Odessa's great escape scheme would have been discovered and broken up. Skipping down. In December of 1943, at the latest, Galen reached the same conclusion about the war that had come upon Bormann, Schacht, Skorzeny, and Himmler. Germany was losing and could do nothing about it. Several months later, Galen says, he began quietly discussing the impending defeat with a few close associates. As he writes in his memoir, quote, "Early in October of 1944, I told my more intimate colleagues that I considered the war was lost and we must begin thinking of the future. We had to think ahead and plan for the approaching catastrophe," unquote. Galen's strategic response to Götterdämmerung was a kind of fusion of Himmler's philosophy with Bormann's more pessimistic Odessa line. "My view," he writes, "was that there would be a place even for Germany in a Europe rearmed for defense against communism. Therefore, we must set our sights on the Western powers and give ourselves two objectives, to help defend against communist expansion and to recover and reunify Germany's lost territories." Just as Bormann, Skorzeny, and Schacht were beginning to execute their escape plans, so too was Galen. Quote, "Setting his sights on the Western powers," unquote, and in particular the United States, Galen pursued the following strategic rationale. When the alliance between the United States and the USSR collapsed, as it was bound to do upon Germany's defeat, the United States would discover a piercing need for a top-quality intelligence service in Eastern Europe and inside the Soviet Union. It did not have such a service of its own, and the pressures of the erupting East-West conflict would not give it time to develop one from scratch. Let the United States therefore leave the assets assembled by Galen and the FHO intact. Let the United States not break up Galen's relationship with East European fascist groups. Let the United States pick up Galen's organization and put it to work for the West, the better to prevail in its coming struggle against the Soviet Union, soon to become its ex-ally. Well, the rest of the story of the incorporation of the Galen organization we have spoken about in the past. The aforementioned Radio Free America references are important, and I would recommend listeners to those. Continuing with Oglesby's article, Galen was encouraged to resume contact with his Fremde Heere Ost comrades who were still at large in Bavaria, releasing them from their vow of silence. Galen was sufficiently confident of his American relationships by this time that he dug up his buried files and, in special camps, put his FHO experts to work preparing detailed reports on the Red Army for his American captors. Well before the end of June, he and his comrades were, quote, "discharged from prisoner of war status so that we could move around at will," unquote. They were encouraged to form a unit termed a, quote, "general staff cell," unquote, first within G2's historical research section, then later in the 7th Army's Intelligence Center in Wiesbaden, where they worked in private quarters and were treated as VIPs. Indeed, a partly declassified CIA document recapitulated this story in the early 1970s, noting that at this time, quote, Galen met with Admiral Karl Dönitz, D-O-E-N-I-T-Z, who had been appointed by Hitler as his successor during the last days of the Third Reich. Galen and the Admiral were now in a U.S. Army VIP prison camp in Wiesbaden. Galen sought and received approval from Dönitz, too. Oglesby goes on to add, in other words, the German chain of command was still in effect and it approved of what Galen was doing with the Americans. The last sentence again. In other words, the German chain of command was still in effect and it approved of what Galen was doing with the Americans. Well, we have spoken at great length about the Galen Organization and its effect on the country, ranging from the continued guerrilla warfare in Eastern Europe that the Galen Organization waged. We talked about that in Radio Free America number 1, came back to it in number 2. The role of the Galen Organization in the assassination of President Kennedy, again, Radio Free America 4, Guns of November number 4, Radio Free America 11, Radio Free America 13, and Radio Free America 15, excuse me. We've also spoken about some of the domestic Nazi connections to the assassination of President Kennedy, which terrifyingly hooked up with the Galen Organization. Again, Guns of November number 4, a miscellaneous archive show called Lee Harvey Oswald, Edwin Walker, and the Fourth Reich. Also, Radio Free America shows 12 and 13 as well. And the Galen Organization, through Otto Skorzeny, the Odessa fellow referred to earlier, has exerted a profound role on post-World War II terrorism. Radio Free America 14, number 21, and number 22 go into that at considerable detail. Near the end of this very important article by Oglesby, he goes on to describe the significance of the Galen Organization for the United States. And again, he echoes a theme that I first sounded in January of 1989. I replayed that tape for you last week. That basically the Galen Organization literally served as a Trojan horse. One of the things that the Galen Organization did was to deliberately feed the United States misleading intelligence concerning what the Soviets' capabilities and intentions were, and as a result we wound up not only plunging ourselves into a massive and unnecessary under the circumstances Cold War, but as we look back from calendar year 1991, we wound up bankrupting ourselves as well. We have squandered our capital and our best research and development brains on instruments of destruction, while the Germans and Japanese have focused their attentions on building up their infrastructure, their educational system, their manufacturing base, and that is why they have surpassed us and basically control us for all practical purposes to this day. We will be going into this, by the way, in the future. A good book dealing with the misleading intelligence channeled to the U.S. by Galen is the book which is currently available out about 2 years now called Blowback, by Christopher Simpson, hardcover edition, Weidenfeld and Nicholson, copyright 1988. In summation here, Oglesby describes the Galen Organization's effect on the United States, and in particular its function as a vehicle for the Odessa. Oglesby writes, in making the Galen deal, the United States did not acquire for itself an intelligence service. This is not what the Galen Group was or was trying to be. The military intelligence historian Colonel William Corson, C-O-R-S-O-N, put it most succinctly, quote, Galen's organization was designed to protect the Odessa Nazis. It amounts to an exceptionally well-orchestrated diversion, unquote. The only intelligence provided by the Galen net to the United States was intelligence selected specifically to worsen East-West tensions and increase the possibility of military conflict within the U.S. and the Soviet Union. It was exactly as the right-wing papers had warned in 1945 when they were aroused by Donovan's proposal for a permanent intelligence corps, warning their readers that a, quote, super spy unit, unquote, could, quote, determine American foreign policy by weeding out, withholding, or coloring information gathered at his direction, unquote. It was exactly as Truman had warned when he demobilized the OSS, with the observation that the U.S. had no interest in, quote, Gestapo-like measures, unquote. The fact that this lively concern for a police state apparatus should have been focused on the relatively innocuous OSS, while at the same time the red carpet was being rolled out for Galen's gang of SS men, must surely count as one of the supreme wrenching ironies of the modern period. Another dimension of the cost of the Galen deal is the stress it induced within American institutions, weakening them incalculably. That last sentence again. Another dimension of the cost of the Galen deal is the stress it induced within American institutions, weakening them incalculably. word that's kind of tough for me to pronounce, incalculably. There we go. The Galen Organization was the antithesis of the Allied cause, its sinister emergence on the scene of post-war Europe, the very opposite of what the Western democracies thought they had been fighting for. Perhaps at least we can say that despite Galen, and despite the military, the United States did, after all, finally wind up with a civilian intelligence service. The National Security Act of 1947 did embody Donovan's central point in creating a CIA outside the military. But in fact, the Galen Org substantially preempted the CIA's civilian character before it was ever born. The CIA was born to be rocked in Galen's cradle. It remained dependent on the Org even when the Org turned into the BND. Thus, whatever the CIA was from the standpoint of the law, it remained from the standpoint of practical intelligence collection, a front for a house of Nazi spies. The Org was not merely military, which is bad, not merely foreign, which is much worse, and not merely Nazi, which is intolerable. It was not even professionally committed to the security of the U.S. and Western Europe. That last sentence again. The Org was not merely military, which is bad, not merely foreign, which is much worse, and not merely Nazi, which is intolerable. It was not even professionally committed to the security of the U.S. and Western Europe. It was committed exclusively to the security of the Odessa. All the Galen Org ever wanted the U.S. to be was anti-communist. The more militantly so, the better. It never cared in the least for the security of the United States, its Constitution, or its democratic tradition. It is not the point of this essay that there would have been no Cold War if the Odessa had not wanted it and had not been able, through the naive collaboration of the American military right, to place Galen and his network in a position that ought to have been occupied by a descendant of the OSS. But it was precisely because the world was so volatile and confusing as of the transition from World War II to peacetime that the U.S. needed to see it, as Donovan put it in plaintive appeal to Truman in the summer of 1945, through American eyes, unquote. No Nazi eyes, however bright, could see it for us without deceiving us and leading us to the betrayal of our own national character. The last sentence again, because it's an important one. No Nazi eyes, however bright, could see it for us without deceiving us and leading us to the betrayal of our own national character. Second, there was no way to avoid the Cold War once we had taken the desperate step of opening our doors to Galen. From that moment on, from the summer of 1945, when the Army brought him into the United States and made a secret deal with him, the Cold War was locked in. A number of Cold War historians on the left, for example, D.F. Fleming and Gabriel Kolko, K-O-L-K-O, have made cogent arguments that from the Soviet point of view, the Cold War was not inevitable even as late as 1947. According to standard American history, in fact, it was only in 1947 that the Cold War was thrust upon us by an irrational and belligerent Stalin. The secret of the Treaty of Fort Hunt exposes this history, quote-unquote, as a self-serving political illusion. On the contrary, the war in the Pacific was still raging and the United States was still trying to get the Soviet Union into the war against Japan when General Siebert, S-I-B-E-R-T, was already deep into his relationship with Galen. That, by the way, was one of the American generals most involved with setting up the liaison with Galen. Continuing. The key point that comes crashing through the practical and moral confusion about this matter, once one sees that Galen's organization was an arm of the Odessa, is that whether it was ethical or not, the U.S. did not pick up a gift horse in Galen at all. It picked up a Trojan horse. That indeed is what I said in 1989. I echoed it earlier this year, or actually August of last year, as we're now into 1991. It's worth noting that the Galen Organization, again, has exerted a profound influence on the United States. One of the things that it did was to set up guerrilla groups in the rear of the Soviet Army as they retreated, the Nazis retreated during World War II. Those guerrilla groups waged a fierce warfare against the Soviet Union, and some of them are still working as late as 1952. They, as we looked at in Radio Free America 1 and continued with number 2, jumped to the United States and the CIA, thereby basically representing a continuation of the warfare of World War II, the Galen guerrillas basically simply switching uniforms from Germany to the United States.